Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. This program often focuses on stories that dominate the halls of power from the Beltway to Brussels and Beijing. But we wanted to examine a crisis today that is not getting much attention in those places, and it should. I'm talking about Haiti. Quite simply, Haiti is in deep trouble. This is the biggest security crisis in the Western Hemisphere. More than 80% of Haiti's capital is controlled by gangs. Violence in Port-au-Prince has driven more than 160,000 people to flee, 50,000 of them in just the last few weeks. How did we get here? When it comes to Haiti, there are many, many moments in history you could point to as causes for the current strife. After all, the Haitian Revolution that began in the 1790s was one of the biggest slave rebellions ever recorded in the West, and it was followed by Haiti having to pay reparations to France. Imagine that, not France to Haiti, but the other way round. But the most proximate flashpoint was in late February, when acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry was out of the country and major gangs coordinated to attack state institutions. They burnt police stations, sprung inmates from prison, and attacked the seaport and the airport. The city is now cut off from supplies of food and medicine, and aid organizations are warning of an impending famine. This is a humanitarian crisis the likes of which has not been seen since the massive earthquake there in 2010. All of this, as it often does, is happening in a political vacuum. In July 2021, President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated by armed gunmen inside his home. We still don't know who was responsible. A month ago, the unelected, Western-backed Henri announced that he would resign, but only after the installation of a transitional presidential council. That council, after weeks of negotiation, finalized their political framework earlier this week. As of this taping, it is now up to Henri to accept it. Will he? What does a democratic transition for Haiti look like? Can Haitian police quell the violence, or will an international force be deployed to help them? Those are the questions we are going to explore the answers to. With me this week are two people who have been closely following this crisis. Jacqueline Charles is the Miami Herald's award-winning Caribbean correspondent. She's covered Haiti for more than a decade. And Jake Johnston is a senior research associate for the Center for Economic Policy and Research. He is the author of a timely new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. Remember, if you like this podcast, you can try us on video, live, on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too, and you know you want to. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. Let's dive in. Jacqueline, Jake, welcome to FP Live.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you on, and thanks for making us smarter about Haiti. Jacqueline, I wanted to start with you. I know you have extensive contacts in Haiti within family and, of course, all of your diplomatic sources. Paint us a picture. What is life like for people on the ground right now?
I mean, if there's one word I can think about, it's just panic. You just don't know what every day is going to bring. You wake up and you hear the gunshots. I mean, people are telling me that when they don't hear the gunfire, that's when they start to panic and wonder what's wrong, because now it's become such a constant theme for them. Unfortunately, with the vandalism, the burning, the looting of hospitals, it's very difficult to get healthcare. And as somebody said today, people still get sick. Just last week, I interviewed a young lady who's literally is watching her mother die. Her mother had not had dialysis in basically like 6 weeks, because the only place that she could get it, the general hospital, was basically, not functioning because gangs had taken over that entire road. You can't go anywhere. If you take that risk, you don't know whether you're going to be the next victim. I mean, doctor said that, you get a phone call from a patient, and first there's the sense of panic for you in terms of taking this personal risk, the safety to go out. And then when you get there, what do you do when there's no medication? The store shelves are starting to run bare. In about 2 weeks or less, we're going to really start to see a humanitarian crisis, because it's not just the people in the camps, but also the people who are not in the camps, who are not going to be able to find food because the airport, the seaport, has been shut down for over a month now.
Jake, I'm wondering if you can add to that. What are you hearing about what's going on in Haiti, and where do you rank this in terms of other crises Haiti has had in the past?
Yeah, I think in almost every way this is unprecedented, at least in recent history. I think you've heard for years. And again, I think we need to understand that this didn't just happen a month ago. This has been a long time coming and a long time building. There have been warnings about it reaching this stage for many years, right? And yet we've just sort of continually seen this. And I mean, I think Jackie's right around the situation on the ground. I mean, I think things are obviously really tense, and I think there's also just this unknown, partially because nobody is speaking, right? The authorities that are currently in power, and Henri is out of the country, totally silent. This presidential council that's being formed with the backing of international powers, also totally silent. And in that absence, who is speaking are the leaders of armed groups, are politicians on the ground who are advocating for very different things. And so what is the authority? What is the plan? I think everyone's sort of in the dark.
Jacqueline, gangs still control much of the roads, and so they have, control of sorts over the airport, the seaport. How is any humanitarian aid getting in, and what kind of access do aid groups have right now?
So, the UN recently said in a report that last month, 114, I think is the number that they quoted, interruptions in terms of aid, trying to bring aid to individuals primarily in camps. They have been using an air bridge helicopter. The government doesn't have any, and helicopters seem to be the game in town. The US Embassy is using it to get people to pay patient to leave, but they are using that. Some of the private ports have managed to still get some, produce in, but then we saw that the gangs hijacked a boat last week. Those individuals who have managed to get a container or two out, they're paying enormous amount of prices. We're seeing, price of basic food items go up by, over 40%. So it's very difficult. And then the World Food Program, for instance, they're having to make some really tough decisions. I mean, look, the reality is that the UN is asking for $674 million. And the last time I checked, they only received $45 million. So the world is not opening its checkbooks, not even for the humanitarian requests that people are dying. They need food, they need medicine, they need water. And so there are some displacement camps where there is no aid, because there just isn't enough to go around. And so they're having to make decisions just like the police. Where do I go? This place is erupting, this other place. Do I go here? Do I go there? And that, I think, is a real tragedy in this. So today we're having to decide whose lives we attempt to save.
Jake, we hear a lot about the gangs who've taken control of Port-au-Prince. What do they want?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question. Maybe the biggest question I think that remains unanswered. I think we need to understand a few things. One is we have this ostensible coalition, right, that came together to force Henri out. But these are very disparate actors with disparate interests. I think the reality is there's not one goal, right? There are multiple goals, and a lot of different interests at play here. And that's part of why this is so confusing. I think we do have to see this as very connected to the political developments. The history of armed groups in Haiti is closely linked with political and economic interests in Haiti, and I think it remains so today, though obviously the sort of levels of coordination and control perhaps have changed in recent times. But I think, what do we mean by control, right? These armed groups are exercising sort of de facto territorial control, but are not actually replacing the state or taking over state control. And so I think there is a real question of if that's their goal, or if they are intending to increase bargaining power, negotiation, leverage, or support the political aspirations of other actors outside of these armed groups themselves. I think what's been pretty clear, we've seen at least a certain level of tacit coordination between the armed groups and the political ambitions of Guy Philippe, a former paramilitary leader who was recently deported back from the United States after serving time for money laundering charges related to drug trafficking. And so, again, disentangling all of these competing interests and competing motivations is a big challenge.
Jacqueline, it's been a month now since Acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced his resignation, and it looks like a transitional council has been finalized. Who's on that council? What do they hope to achieve?
This has been very interesting to watch because, it's, you know, Jake mentioned in the beginning, you know, no one is talking, but, you know, we're talking, right? we're getting information. And I think the first thing is going to be is that the members of this council have to figure out what their role is. I mean, the criticism coming out of Haiti is that they've given themselves an enormous amount of power that constitutionally president would normally have. So for instance, one of the things that they've said is that they will fire the next prime minister. Well, that's usually the purview of a parliament, because the prime minister is elected. When we looked, you know, there's what you write on paper and then there's the reality. And one of the concerns is that if and when they finally do get a prime minister in a government, are you not duplicating roles? Are we going to go into some sort of paralysis in terms of who's in charge or who should be in charge? Criticisms have been the fact that with this council, you have seven voting members and two observers, but you look at an institution like civil society, which has really played a very active role in all of these years, but they've been given this sort of observer status. There's only one woman on it, and she represents the religious group, which is the other observer. And the others are individuals who at some point, for the most part, I mean, a couple of them have served in government before, older individuals, not necessarily reflecting the demographics or what you're hearing from, you know, the streets. So I think that this council has a huge challenge because some people think that they're going to get into the palace. The palace, by the way, doesn't exist, but there's obsession in terms of being installed and working out of the palace, which has been under repeated attacks. But they think that they're going to get in and just click their finger and tomorrow everything is going to be great and wonderful. And so I think that there's going to be a rude awakening there for, you know, for the individuals. We're wishing them success, but this does not look like a clear path. It looks very murky, very uncertain.
I want to ask you just to talk a little bit more, Jacqueline, about the strength of civil society, because, you know, one criticism of the way in which the world has handled various crises in Haiti over the years is that it hasn't really empowered civil society enough or turned to it enough for its input. And after all, you know, for democracy to flourish, you need it to grow roots from within and you need people to rise up from within. Give us a sense of, you know, how civil society acts today. Is it seen as strong? Does it have strong institutions?
You know, one of the biggest issues with Haiti is the fact that we don't have strong institutions and in some cases, no institutions. And when I think of Haiti civil society in the context of Haiti, I don't even think about my own group in terms of journalists. I think of the human rights sector. I mean, they have been the ones that have literally been the watchdog on this crisis, you know, telling us about the various massacres, the attacks, the how many people have died. I mean, I think about, you know, the La Saline massacre that happened a couple of years ago, and this is where armed gangs and two individuals who were connected to former President Jovenel Moïse's government basically launched an attack in a working class community in Port-au-Prince, and even babies were killed. I mean, we learned about that because of the human rights groups. And so, you know, in a country where everything has been crumbling for years, I mean, they have managed to stay there and to be, you know, the eyes and ears. And we also have watched too, where in this frustration over the deteriorating circumstances, you get the sense sometimes it's like, we're gonna pick our fights because not everything, you know, gets called out, but it's under tremendous pressure, threats to their own lives, to their own survival, that they do the work that they do. And when you look at the U.S.'s report on the human rights rice situation in Haiti, it's very clear often that they don't have people in the embassies that are doing this. They're actually relying on the work of the human rights sector in Haiti. So today, when you see them sort of take this observation role, and maybe Jake can talk about this more, I mean, it does really, you know, sort of beg the question in terms of where everybody else wanted to go with this and think that who should the actors have been, because there've been a real debate about whether or not the politicians should be the ones leading this council and should it just be like NGOs or civil society and just send the politicians to go campaign for elections.
Jake, I'd love your take on that. And, you know, it's also because when you have this kind of a council, what legitimacy does it have? So do the people see it as something that is the right, the correct instrument to lead them eventually to another election and a democratic leader? Or are they just sort of, you know, a bit more apathetic about it?
Yeah, I think, you know, first on civil society, I think, you know, what we have to understand too is where this idea of a council really began. And that was largely with civil society, who came up with this proposal many years ago to create a council as a check or alternative to the power of Henri. And it was totally discarded by the international community. This was a two-year plan that was unwieldy and too long and not serious, didn't involve political actors, right? And instead, the choice was to continue to back Henri. And so now we're sort of at this point now where it's all happening very rushed, you know, with the sort of threat of violence hanging over everything, and that's making it a lot more difficult. But we do have to understand that that is where the idea of the council came. I think this question of legitimacy is extremely important. I mean, what Jackie is saying around the concerns on the council, I think, are all true. But one of the big concerns around the council also is just that this is a process that is seen as controlled and directed by the international community again, right? And if the problem in the past was that political leaders' legitimacy was coming from outside actors, not from inside Haiti, this certainly is feeding the perception that that same pattern is being repeated. And so, again, I think the council will have to take significant action, right? Regardless of constitutional legitimacy, popular legitimacy is what's going to matter more than anything moving forward. And that's not relevant to what's written on the paper. It's what can they actually provide to the people and what sort of a process can they initiate to broaden this? Because the reality is, I think there has to be some sort of a broader national dialogue that takes place in Haiti. This council can't be the answer by itself, but is potentially, right, an opening to build something on. But whether they are able, both from their own perspective and whether they're constrained by the international actors that have helped coordinate and form this council, you know, that's going to be the big fight moving forward, and whether or not they're able to overcome that to really obtain popular legitimacy inside of Haiti.
But Jake, I just want to follow up. I mean, one of the when I've talked to people who have been involved in the discussions or in these conversations, I mean, they actually were very frustrated because they felt like they were not getting guidance from the international community on this. So those who are like have been on this sort of a rupture mindset, right? They basically felt that internationals were not doing enough and that they were just more of an observer role. And I think that, I mean, and that's one of the biggest issues in Haiti. There's a perception and there's a reality, and oftentimes they don't match, and it doesn't matter what the reality is, there's always this perception of Big Brother. But I think that also the council members haven't done themselves any favors in that it literally has taken over 4 weeks for them to come up, you know, sort of with a, you know, with a political accord. And then it's taken the current government like back and forth to do all of this. And so, you know, and people are saying like, you know, Port-au-Prince is burning and you're, you know, we're having these debates over these little minor details. So again, I don't know how they get out of that, because I think that, yes, the way in which this was brokered, that it took a meeting down in Jamaica with Secretary of State Blinken personally flying down there to get the same actors in a room who, even before Henri, with Jovenel, were fighting Jovenel and refusing to negotiate with him. And then even after this was done, they still couldn't really, they were still fighting, and there were still these issues. So this is a real test. And there's a lot of debates on, you know, but again, the legitimacy issue, we have to remember we are out of a constitution. Even those who have talked about a judge, well, the amended constitution does not provide that route for, you know, for a judge. So,
and there's a question over the legitimacy of the judges themselves, right? There are going to be constitutional questions raised about any possible solution. And so that's, again, why I would go back to the question of popular legitimacy, because it's what any government results, whether it's one person from a court, whether it's a council, whether it's Guy Philippe. I mean, the reality is that the individual or the structure is not what's important as much as what they can actually do and what they can show to a population to actually get support. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, Jack. I mean, I don't think the blame entirely is on the international community. And I did say perception, right? Because I think that is important. But who has spoken on behalf of this council, right? We've seen a few statements, written statements. But publicly, you know, it was international diplomats, it was foreign diplomats that were speaking about this negotiation that was happening, right? They were speaking in English to an international audience and not to people in Haiti.
Well, they were invited initially, right? To the Bahamas in English.
I want to do something here. So in a bit, I want to look at the path forward and the role of the international community. And I want to take some subscriber questions. But before we do any of that, I think what could be really helpful here is to take a little bit of a look back. I want to get a better sense of how we got here. And Jake, maybe I begin with you here. I mean, it's been almost 3 years since Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in his home. We still don't know exactly who was responsible for that. But as I said earlier, there are many, many moments in history that you could point to as a key reason why we got here. If you were to quickly summarize why we're here, what would you point to?
Yeah, well, quickly is going to be the operative word there. I mean, I think there's a long history and it all builds off each other, right? This is decades of foreign policy decisions, of local decisions, of economic policies, right? I think for me, I think at the root of so much of this is the inability of Haiti to actually have a sovereign democracy, right? It's been interfered with for so long, whether that be coups. I think we can overturn election results. And I think that's where I would start with the present situation is the overturning of the 2010-2011 election results after the earthquake then. And this really changed the trajectory of Haiti, both in terms of its democracy, but also accompanied by billions of dollars in foreign assistance, right? And these two dynamics of money that largely bypassed the government, bypassed local institutions, have largely undermined some of these domestic organizations, grassroots organizing, combined with a really heavy hand on the political side of things, choosing Haiti's leaders, and being that we've seen this over time, over the last 15 years, steadily declining participation, erosion of any faith in democracy, and the inability of Haitians to chart their own path forward. And in the absence of that, in this sort of decimation of democracy, right, you've had this sort of turn to paramilitary violence, to settling political scores through violence rather than through other means. And I think that sort of breakdown is, again, at the heart of so much of this. And that's not just a story about Haiti. That's a story also about the role of international actors in Haiti and foreign policy decisions from the U.S., from the United Nations, and from other countries that have helped destabilize the situation and cause the present situation.
Jacqueline, I'd love your take on the same question.
I always go back to the 2010 earthquake. I mean, I just remember the pressure that was being put on late President René Préval to have an election at all costs, literally amidst the debris. I remember the government announcing that the death toll was 316,000. And I love whenever I look at the numbers, either from USAID or the US government or whatever, the numbers are always something else. And that to me says so much, because it's like, we don't believe you and we're going to tell you what it is. But even before the quake, you know, there was a measure of stability that in that country, but it wasn't good enough. They started talking about a quote unquote paradigm shift, and we saw that go into play. And what that has done is truly undermine the confidence that the average Haitian has in the democratic process. They'll say, well, why should I vote? Because the blanc, the foreigner, is going to choose for me anyway. And what we have seen, you know, since then is just this downward spiral, you know, from, you know, the push to remove the UN peacekeeping mission when everybody knew that the Haitian police was not yet capable of doing the security because they hadn't invested in that, and we hadn't done the work that we needed to do in order to give them the tools that they needed, to ignoring you know, the rise of these armed groups. I remember having conversations with people and saying, look, you know, we're looking at this. This seems to be connected to elections, or every time they talk about elections, we start to see a spike in violence. And it kept getting, no, this is about territorial wars. This is about territorial wars. I mean, I've always said that we're always sort of a day late and a dollar short. I mean, there are times that Haiti gets treated like a five-year-old when it should be treated like, you know, a full-grown adult. And there are times it gets treated like a full-grown adult when it should be treated like a five-year-old. They just always seem to be very short until we land in the current crisis that we're in. Didn't start 3 years ago.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other things, including our magazine. Sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That is FPLIVE, one word.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Jake, you know, in your book, which FP reviewed, and I urge everyone to read the review and your book, of course, part of the case you make is that a lot of the foreign actors, aid organizations, and contractors of aid organizations, there wasn't enough accountability for the actions that they undertook. I'm curious whether the Haitian people know that and understand that, and whether they would trust any foreign external involvement in the coming months and years were that to happen.
Well, I think there's a huge lack of trust. I mean, there's a certain hypocrisy too. I mean, you know, we always talk about corruption in Haiti or lack of accountability in Haiti, and those things are real. But of course, developed countries suffer from the exact same problems. We don't hold our aid contractors accountable. The UN never held itself accountable for introducing cholera to Haiti, right? I mean, these are huge things that the international community has failed to lead by example, right? And then demand the changes from Haiti. I think we also, though, have to understand that the Haitian people are in an extraordinarily difficult situation, not just because of the acute crisis on the ground, but because of the options that are in front of them. You have armed gangs that they certainly do not trust widely. You have international community that is not trusted widely. You have a political and economic elite who is not trusted. And so amongst those actors, again, none of them are your ideal choice, right? I think it's the question becomes, right, which one is actually going to act and do something for me? Which one could do that? I think in an ideal world, people want to see the Haitian police strengthened. They want to see their own government step up and change and do something. But these things are all interrelated, of course, because they also have that perception that their government is created by international actors too, right? And so these things all feed each other. The reality, though, is what that leaves is a place where there is not a clear good option or an option that is obvious to trust. And again, I go back to this question. It's what will actually happen and what can be done to build that trust. It's not going to be given before something is done. It's going to have to be earned and proven.
Jacqueline, what about the role of the police here? Are they seen as a force that can be trusted? Jake just mentioned that they should be strengthened. Do you agree with that, and how so?
Well, you know, there is recent polls I keep thinking about in the last couple of years. And when you saw the polls, Haitians basically, you know, they said that they don't believe that their police can address this problem, this security crisis. It's a numbers game. You have a police force that it's not even 9,000 on active duty throughout the entire country. I just read a report that says it was 3,000, maybe. Those who are involved in the security forces are only, you know, or maybe a couple of hundreds. You know, I know police officers personally who are sleeping in the police stations because their own homes have been overtaken or burned by gangs. There seems to be this attitude that this is some sort of a human, you know, superhuman group. You know, when they're not, they're individuals. They're real people. And while they do have problems, and or certainly has suffered from a lack of vetting, you know, poor payments not on time, relations with some of these armed groups because of where they live. But what you have seen is that there has been a commitment in the last couple of weeks. I mean, they're the only ones standing between what you have now in complete chaos. And one wonders, you know, how long can they continue to stand up?
I think just to add to that with the police, I mean, I think the police have been the sort of last line of defense, obviously. I think there is also, you know, I mentioned the trust deficit with these other actors. There's a trust deficit with the police too, right? I think the majority of the population in Haiti, you know, their experience with the police is getting tear gassed in a protest by the police as much as anything, right? They see police officers working private security or doing, you know, specific things for private sector actors. We talk about some things getting out of the port now. I mean, that's happening because the police are getting paid by the private sector to remove and help provide security for certain things coming out of the ports. Armed groups are also getting paid for that. These negotiations and things are happening all the time. And so, you know, strengthening the police is not something that can happen in a vacuum, right? It has to happen with other changes. And like these other things, it's about establishing trust and earning that trust. Where we've seen the most success, I think, with the police in recent months certainly has been where they have deeper relationships with the communities that they're defending. And you've seen communities working hand in hand with the police that have actually tried to, you know, keep neighborhoods safe and had some limited success in that fashion. And so I think that does speak to rebuilding that trust and what you can do to do so to try and strengthen the police also. But like Jackie said, I mean, there are police officers who aren't even getting paid. And so we're talking about, you know, bringing in foreign troops and things like this and spending hundreds of millions of dollars. But you've got police who are putting their lives on the line every single day, whose families are under threat. They're sleeping, you know, in a, basically a displaced person site, and they have no direct support. And they see this attention elsewhere. That also has an effect, right? And so I think we do need to understand these broader dynamics at play as well.
I mean, I get calls from cops all the time. You know, are they coming? Are they coming? I mean, they want this help. I mean, they feel overwhelmed by it. But I think that what I'm hearing Jake say, and probably what I am definitely also saying, is that the bottom line is you have to empower Haitians to empower themselves. And I think that this is where the mark has been, because there's such a distrust throughout all of these different relationships and what have you, and dynamics. And you have a group of people who don't really believe, you know, that in the power of in democracy, the power of their vote. And so the challenge is, how do you empower the individuals on the ground to hold others accountable, regardless of whether it's police officers, this new council, an elected leader, to take back their lives?
So I think that is exactly the prompt I wanted to take us towards. And Jake, let me put that to you in the time we have left to look at possible solutions. So answering the question of how, if you were to put power in the hands of Haitians, how to give them the ability to rebuild their state, where does that begin?
I think it begins with dialogue, right? And it sounds sort of simplistic to say, but I think it's the only path. I think we also need to understand two things. I mean, for a year and a half, we've been talking about external security intervention as sort of imminent or, you know, the only solution to Haiti's security crisis. And I think regardless of what we think about that, it's not happening tomorrow. We can't just sit around and wait for that. Haitian actors can't just sit around and wait for that, right? It needs to be about what can be happening now. And I think that process needs to start with a dialogue. And it's not just a dialogue among seven people with CARICOM to form this council. It's a dialogue across the country, right? This is not just Port-au-Prince. This is a big country with interests all over the provinces and big things happening. And how can you bridge these longstanding gaps, right? This gap between urban and rural, between Bétionville and Upper Port-au-Prince and the sort of popular neighborhoods downtown, right? There are huge divisions here, and the effort to overcome them has to be through dialogue for me. And, you know, I think there's a lot of pushback on this to a certain extent, saying, you know, we can't give, you know, armed groups a seat at the table. And I'm not suggesting that be, you know, exactly what happens, or giving amnesty or things like this. But I do think we need to be honest about that this is not something that can be attacked only with force, that this is a bigger issue about a broken social contract, about a state that has left big parts of the country behind. And if we're trying to bridge those gaps, we're trying to get at the root causes of what generates this instability and empowering the Haitian people to actually take charge of their state, they need to actually be a part of that discussion in some meaningful way.
So what Jake, I have to say, though, I get that. And Jacqueline, maybe I put this to you. I get what Jake is saying, but aren't there many steps before you can get to that stage? I mean, with gangs running amok across Port-au-Prince, what kind of international intervention is needed, and how would such an intervention be legitimized or seen as legitimate by Haitian people?
I think the first thing today is security. I mean, the average Haitian wants security. They want to be able, you asked me a question in the beginning, they want to be able to wake up in the morning, you know, and not panic. You know, I remember last year, I visited a school. And when I was standing in the school, I'm watching these kids, and I realized that these are kids that can be at any classroom in America or anywhere around the world. And, you know, I've seen 300,000 dead. I've seen so much. And things, you know, you develop sort of an iron, you know, heart here. But I literally started crying, because in that moment, I started thinking about what it took every morning for those kids to come to school, what it takes in the afternoon, and the fact that while they're there, their parents cannot depend on them being safe and was still in panic because schools are no longer off limits and schools are also being attacked. So I think that, one, we need to figure out how to put security back. But I've seen the dialogue and I see the divisions that exist. And I think the divisions are so deep because they go back centuries. And my argument to what Jake would say would be institutions. We need to start to build institutions in this country because we've had them. And when you start to put institutions in place and you really provide them with the support, then they can start to do the work, the grassroots work in these various communities and figure out how in this country of many realities, we find a way that we can continue to move forward together, even if we don't agree and we still have our divisions. But I feel that trying to get past these divisions is not gonna get us to where we need to get right away. We need to deal with security and institution building.
Jaikin, you've been critical of the way in which past international interventions have affected Haiti. If there were any international interventions at all, what should that look like?
Well, look, I mean, I think this is the same principles that we've been talking about this whole conversation, which is empowering Haitians to actually have the lead. And, you know, we talk about this political accord. I mean, so the political accord, right, we've seen the text, right? It calls for the creation of a National Security Council that will define the support that comes from the international community. The council needs to be able to exert its independence from the actors that help form it and set the agenda for what kind of support it needs. I don't know what the answer to that is, right? They're going to convene experts. They're going to come up with a plan. But the international community can't set that agenda beforehand and then force it upon them. They need to allow them to set that agenda and ask for the help that is necessary and then oversee that help and make sure it actually builds something sustainable. I mean, we talk about MINUSTAH and MINUSTAH leaving. I mean, I think the problem is not that MINUSTAH left. It's that MINUSTAH was never a solution. MINUSTAH was a cover because it allowed the political and economic elite to not make the changes that were necessary to actually resolve the roots of instability in Haiti. So long as there was a foreign force there, they could continue with business as usual. And I think that's definitely a concern today, is if we just import security and provide that facade of security, what happens when they leave? I mean, I can tell you in Washington, I mean, it's basically an open secret, this Kenya MSS, right, 9 months term, this is not the plan. This is not the end goal. This is the opening. The plan is another long-term security mission in Haiti. Is that a real long-term solution for Haiti or not? The Haitian people haven't been consulted about that. That's not part of this discussion right now. It's happening behind closed doors here in Washington. I think, you know, that is a perpetuation of the roots of so much of this crisis.
And I just want to point out for people who aren't familiar, MINUSTAH is the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti. It was active from 2004 to 2017. I want to take some subscriber questions. Jacqueline, I'm going to put the first one to you. This is from James Herberg. And his question is about Haitians who are trying to flee. What options are available to them, given that neighboring Dominican Republic is not allowing migrants in, and the Biden administration has maintained fairly restrictive policies as well?
Well, there really isn't a lot of options. And the reason I believe that we haven't seen some sort of a quote, migration crisis is because the gangs continue to control the routes outside of Port-au-Prince. But the Biden administration has made it very clear that Haitians who take to the sea will be returned back to Haiti despite the current situation, and that people should not try to, you know, try to leave. So we've seen even with Haitians who are green card holders in the United States that they were not allowed to go through the Dominican Republic to try to get out. And when the U.S. government was pulling people out, it was only for U.S. citizens, not even for, you know, legitimate green card holders, which I still haven't been able to figure the answer for that. Maybe Jake knows.
Jake, the Dominican Republic's former special envoy to the UN Security Council, Jose Singer, has written in with a question, and he's arguing that most Haitians actually want a purely presidential system, and he points to the need for a constitutional process for such a change, but worries that low turnout in elections would lead to weaker governments. What's your take?
I think low turnout in elections certainly has led to weaker governance. I think that's a big part of what got us here. I can go back to what Jackie and I were saying earlier. Whether it's a seven-member council or a member of the judge, there are going to be people who question the constitutional authority of this, because let's be honest about this. Things have been outside of constitutional norms for a very long time. And so, again, for me, it's what can actually be done to restore trust. And I think, you know, this is why just a rush to elections was never an option and remains not a good option today, is because you can't just repeat the same cycle. You can't just hold elections if nobody has trust in them. And so the process of organizing elections is not just getting the security in place to be able to have elections. It's creating trust in the electoral system. It's giving voters a reason to actually care about who represents them at the governmental level. Because the reality is, I mean, you know, we talk a lot about power vacuums right now and the lack of a government in place. But for most people in Haiti, the government is not present in their lives, hasn't been present in their lives. And so that dynamic is going to have to change if people are going to care about voting.
Mm. Jacqueline, you've been covering Haiti for so many years, and many of our viewers will know that you were a Pulitzer Prize finalist for your coverage of the 2010 earthquake. And in many ways, that was the year that a lot of Americans, at least, got to learn a little bit about Haiti. But then, as we were discussing earlier, Haiti has receded from the headlines. Does the level of attention to this particular crisis in 2024, does it feel different?
Well, of course. I mean, it's still not what it was in 2010. I think in 2010, I mean, people were moved. And we saw so many implications. I mean, you know, young Haitian Americans who, you know, either didn't speak the language, never been to Haiti, but they really wanted they wanted a different narrative, and they embraced Haiti in a different kind of way. But then what we saw, the reaction international community was like, you know, they created this, you know, IHRC, you know, a Haiti commission that was chaired by President Bill Clinton. And I remember President Clinton being very frustrated when he realized that despite all the hype, there was no money there for grassroots organization. There was no money there going to the Haitian government. You know, the USAIDs of the world were still holding on to their money. And so that really left a very bitter taste in the mouth of a lot of people, the majority of people. And, you know, billions were promised and it never came. And the government didn't steal it either, is what I continue to tell people. And I think what's today is that we're not even seeing that level of response from humanitarian actors. Again, $674 million that the UN is saying we need to get medicines, to get water, to get basic sanitation. Cholera is back. And so far, they've only raised $45 million. And that is the question. And it's, to me, it's beyond Haiti fatigue. It's not Haiti fatigue. It's like, why aren't people opening up their checkbooks to say, we want to save a life? And Haitians today feel that their lives don't matter.
Jake, a lot of U.S. policymakers watch this program. If you could speak directly to them, what do you think Washington should do?
Well, I think the first thing for Washington to do is to stop turning Haiti into a political football, right? And we've seen this time and time again, where it becomes an issue of political expediency or political rhetoric here in Washington. I think we're seeing that right now. You have Republicans criticizing Democrats over stoking migration from Haiti. Democrats responding by blaming Republicans for holding up funding to prevent that's preventing them from stabilizing Haiti. This is not about Haiti, right? That's not about what Haiti needs or the best way for the U.S. to interact with Haiti, right? So I think we need to get out of that political realm. And that's difficult. It's an election year in the U.S., but this has been something we've seen time and time again in history, is electoral politics in the U.S. affecting U.S. policy to Haiti, and not for the right reasons. Right, so we need to focus on that, like what the actual issues are here, and how best to support them. And I think the other thing, for from a U.S. perspective, you know, I make this point in some detail in the book, is that, you know, I think certainly from the U.S. perspective, we have this vision of Haiti, right? This failed state that doesn't have capacity and that can't do things on its own, and that Haiti needs to change for our efforts to help it to work better. And I think that flips it on its head, right? It needs to be flipped totally around. We've designed a system in terms of foreign assistance that is just not terribly effective. It doesn't work that well for the people on the ground. It works okay for some interests here. And so we can make changes to US policy. We can reform the way we interact with the world so that the way that we provide that support can actually be more effective. And so instead of turning this on Haiti and saying, hey, you need to change, you need to fix your act or get things together, we need to get our act together, right? We need to fix the way we do business and make sure that our policies can actually be effective.
Now, let me follow up with, you know, the point too, is that in this current crisis with the gangs, you know, diplomats cannot get out. They're not going out and meeting people. And so even in terms of aid agencies, you know, so the way that we have administered aid, it does not fit this current reality. And so we have this idea that, you know, Haitian organizations are not to be trusted or cannot administer aid, but they are the organizations that are there in the ground, especially outside of Port-au-Prince. So if you want to continue to sort of build this relationship and make sure that people know that you're there, you care, you do have to change the way that you do business, because given the sheer reality of the country that you're dealing with. Otherwise, we're going to keep missing the mark, and we're going to be giving these comments about how much millions of dollars in aid. And then when Jake and I do the research, we're going to find that most of it basically was returned back to Washington Beltway.
And that was Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald and Jake Johnston, the author of Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. As always, if you want to know who's coming up in future episodes of FP Live, head to foreignpolicy.com. FP's Spring Magazine just dropped this week, and it is all about India. The elections there are just starting and will go on through early June. I've written the lead essay in our spring issue, and so I'm going to take your questions on the elections, on Narendra Modi, New Delhi's foreign policy, and what the country's rise means for the world order. Head to our website to send in questions. We would love to hear from you. FP Live, the podcast, is produced by Rosie Julin, and the executive producer of FP Live is Dana Shern. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters, the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an Everyday Ambassador. Coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.